It's quite a good one. And I asked her not to sue me for reading it at the start of the show, and then she favorited that toot, which we'll see how it goes. And then, at the 11th hour, Kent did create a haiku, which was, "The climate has changed, skipping past fair weather friend, just unfair foe now." For which, thank you for that, haiku, Senryu, Kent Pittman, who is in fact joining me. How long does it take you to write that haiku?
It's kind of odd. Usually, once I have settled on an idea, it's not very long. I wrote that like in the last 10 minutes.
But is the idea kind of bubbling up from the depths for a while?
Sometimes, yeah, just a theme strikes me or something, and I think like, oh, I can build something out of that. Sometimes I have a thing I want to say, and it takes really a long time to figure out how to say it. So it's really It's quite variable, really. It's poetry is a it's
Is
a
a fine
fine
art?
thing.
It could be.
It is kind of that way. Yeah, some of them are built kind of intellectually, and some of them just pop out in weird ways.
I like your description so much more than I like. Do you remember Edgar Allan Poe's description of poetry? How he claimed he was doing this like Dijkstrian logical science, where the Raven by Edgar Allan Poe, he said he constructed to be the most perfect poem ever, which
Well,
you'd like to believe he was being tongue in cheek.
sometimes I must say it really depends on the circumstance. And in the context of this show, like one thing I could say is that in 1985, I wrote a paper on condition handling, and it was a working paper at MIT, and it never really, I mean, I have come to think that that's a weird concept. MIT had these two tracks, one of which was working papers and one was memos. And the idea of a working paper was that it wasn't intended for reference in the literature, and that a memo was. And I came to see that as odd because really it's the people that read it that should make that choice, not the people that write it. So picking that track is odd because it was sitting around for a long time, and it ended up being, I think, one of the more important papers that I wrote. Whereas I wrote something for the memo track that was, a few people have followed up on it and stuff, but I don't think of that as nearly as important. And so, it's what happened was in 1990, 5 years later, really no one had done anything with that, and I thought these are still good ideas, and I will write a paper for the, I think it was the first European Conference on Practical Application of Lisp, EuroPal. And so I had already written the paper, it was the 85 paper, and I looked at it and I thought, well, there's a competition for best paper. I guess I will look at this paper and figure out what about it doesn't look award-winning. And I sat around just kind of chipping away at it and reforming it, and trying to make it into structurally an award-winning paper. It did actually win best paper for that conference. But I'm not sure it really didn't start that way. It was, whether it's the idea or the presentation, it's a little hard to say.
I hope I can recapitulate that with my original deep learning receiver operating characteristic formulation, where when I go back and look at my own writing for it, I it's kind of two articles. The first article is kind of primordial ooze, and then the second article, I can see all of the mathematics is there and checkably works, but I can only really get this from the paper because I personally wrote it, and I should try and chip away and try to make something other people can consume. Sorry for riffing on that in my
No,
own way.
that's exactly the thing. I mean, I was riffing on an elephant joke that I learned when I was in like first grade or something like that, which is like, how do you make a statue of an elephant? And the answer is you get a big block of stone and you chip away everything that doesn't look like an elephant. So, you know, pretty much
Depends
the
which
same,
part of
really.
the elephant you're familiar with as well to make some kind of pun. I just want to say hi to everyone actively participating in Lambda at the moment. And then we'll get into like my serious journalism and news and climate adjacent segment. So if I at here in Lambda, in Jelamut's sushi place on the model railway in Lambdamu, we're currently joined by Northern Lights, whose show is the musical one preceding this one, Praise Then Darkness. Cat K of Bod.baby, gopher colon slash slash BAUD dot baby, I guess. MDH being MDHughes.tech, game dev of the ages. Gopher, I'm gonna say, is cyberhole.online. We're joined by yours truly, Screwtape in the Moo, though I go by Screwlisp now, some reference to Mousebot and Wintermute BBS. We're joined by Edudge after some 20 hours of painful traveling. She's currently baking cookies. At least I'm looking forward to hearing how the cookies turned out and maybe getting the recipe. Jeremy underscore list, my fellow Kiwi, who will be able to report me to our government when I leak government secrets in a moment. Foolspain, Doug Merritt was just saying, hey, don't criticize the Raven. Yeah, I mean, we all remember all of the Raven for a reason. It is a great poem, but I do suggest reading the essay Poe wrote about writing the Raven. Kent, did complete side note before we finish this list of people. Have you spoken to, did you come too late to the scene to speak to or have a sharp exchange with Dykstra out of curiosity?
I've never spoken to Dykstra. I hear quotes from him from time to time. Sounds like an
Because
interesting guy,
he,
but yeah.
I guess we often give early on, before I had read very much Dykstra, he came across as quite like a fierce and like hypercritical and kind of logical character. But then after you've actually read some of his articles, he really has a sense of humor, and a lot of his edge is a sense of humor. Do you agree with that?
I don't know if I've read
Description of
enough of
Dykstra.
his stuff to really say, but I will say in general of our community that a lot of the smart people are really just like bored and trying to entertain their friends and trying to take fun positions
Yeah,
and
so
see
that's a good
what,
description of
yeah.
him. I think so, and lots of people, in fact. I should finish this list quickly.
I mean, many of us
Got
take our positions just to see if what other people have to say, and it works better to take a strong position. So,
Yeah, advocating for the devil, right? You know,
yeah, don't let me
if
derail your list.
everybody timidly agrees, nothing is going to get anywhere. Oh, I'm actually with Cat K here. Cat, I really like the Conquer Worm, but my justification for liking that poem is that it's a very hard poem to like. And so I feel smug about having that as my favorite Poe poem, I think. And I probably couldn't recite much of the Conqueror Worm either. Oh, okay, I'm not going to try to do that. But we're also joined by Gothpenny, Jazzmaz of SDF's Vintage CompuTalk, and Ratsu, as always, is here. Harry Larry is away doing something incredible, I think jazz music adjacent. Oh, we've been joined by GGXX in the meantime as well. GGXX has a mirror and instructions for successfully installing ARMU mode in your Emacs, if you need that to moo. And really, just in the past week, I've begun wizarding my own moos. So this is more critical than ever. Northern Lights is telling me Harry Larry has jazz school, I think. Oh, the school he was referring to was jazz school. That's incredible. Welcome to Jelamut, who's here as well. So in our virtual reality, we all see Cat K laughs. Jelamut enters from the corner of Main Street and Queens Boulevard through the door to the north. Jelamuth waves to da 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 da. He has a wave face. feature object installed, I guess. Ratsu to Jlmut. Heya. And so on and so forth. Oh, and we're joined by NetSettler, who's the other person we can hear, Kent Pittman in Lambdamu, if you'll forgive me for doxing you, I guess, there.
Yeah, that's fine.
What were we going to say? Well, I've been sidetracked because Preho has released an absolutely incredible Unix underscore surrealism portrait drawing while we were talking.
I know you had LLM things you wanted to get to, but there may have been other things as well.
Yeah. I was going to mention that Idaj has her chocolate chip cookie recipe, which I guess I'll post online after the show rather than attempt to read per se. So on the topic of, I guess I talk enough about the New Zealand government as an example of LLM adoption, even though Google really blocks my writing in New Zealand because you get a wonderful notice on Google searches for Screwlisp proposes a toast or something like that, or the Earl. Google gives you a warning. Nobody in New Zealand reads this blog. It seems to only be oriented at American and European readers, which I guess are two Lisp hotspots. Which I was sad that they didn't mention East Asia, but what can you do there? Anyway, so I get messages from relatively senior management figures across the New Zealand government, generally sharing their experiences and kind of scathing criticisms of the LLM experience they're personally having. And then I thought it's good to have Kent here, and we can kind of get Kent's thoughts on what I'm about to dramatically reveal, which is really going to be quite anticlimactic. But I do get these from people who don't know each other across the New Zealand government. So I'm maybe giving a kind of cross-section example here. So one person I was hearing from was kind of, they were describing that they were in kind of a management meeting where the head manager of their division was kind of giving a sort of hype speech to them, in which they were just, people are going to be able to figure out what meeting this was. They were just saying, if you're not prompting, the business world is going to leave you behind. And so this was a management meeting that they were in, and I guess they were waspishly emailing me particularly about this happening. At the same time, somebody else was giving me a much more kind of nuanced take there, where what they were saying was, so they had several parts to this. So they are actively using the LLM both at work and in their personal life, where they say they get through their job and position, like the Copilot Max Plus Ultra Pro, kind of $1 million per month subscription, but they get it through the government, and they're allowed to use it in their personal life as part of having this subscription. And what they were telling me was that there's no current KPI requirement to prompt, but if you don't show that you were using your very expensive Microsoft Copilot subscription in support of your work day to day, they'll cancel the subscription and you'll lose access to your chatbot you're somewhat dependent on potentially in your personal life through work. So in that way, there is a level of coercion to using it. And then what else were they explaining to me? You know, I should have written this down ahead of time. I got slightly sidetracked. They were saying that so because they have to show that they're using this tremendously expensive chatbot subscription because they want to still have it at home, when they're, you know, even though they're a senior manager, they do have to use Microsoft PowerShell quite a lot. And so what they were doing was for routine tasks that they absolutely knew how to do, they would instead ask the bot to kind of do routine tasks, and they could do, the bot would kind of tell them, obviously do this line. And I guess they're kind of, those are kind of nothing interactions, but where they would have previously used their existing expertise in order to keep their subscription to the chatbot, they've had to stop writing it themselves, and now they kind of supplicate the chatbot and paste the chatbot in, and then file that under their argument that they deserve the extremely expensive subscription. The other thing they were describing that they'd found themselves doing at work as part of this justifying their personal chatbot access argument was they said Copilot now asks them to review documentation files in their government SharePoint. So the New Zealand government has a decades-long contract with Microsoft for Microsoft SharePoint, and no government employee knows how to use it. They're constantly sending me messages that they don't know how to use SharePoint, but now Copilot uses SharePoint for them. But what Copilot was asking this manager to do was read like instructional documents or review certain sections of instructional documents, then summarize what the government employee kind of got from that section of the instruction document back to Copilot. And then Copilot would review how the manager had interpreted that chapter of the instructions and then tell them what they needed to do for their job, which is a weird kind of reflective situation. I'm just going to read mdhughes.tech saying, MDH display, I have such a vendetta against Suckpoint. I wrote a really cool database that got killed by a Microsoft contract to use Suckpoint instead. Yeah, Dave Lane, whom I've had on the show before, who is the former New Zealand president of the Free and Open Source Society here, has a similar vendetta. All right, so that you can kind of see where my politics lie, and I guess I get messages from people who agree with me in the New Zealand government. Did you have any thoughts about that? Series of anecdotes, Kent.
Well, I mean, somewhat they're about LLMs, and somewhat it's just business as
Yeah, you're
usual.
welcome to go in another direction.
As the way these things go, I mean, like managers have always like resisted the idea of like having less power. So, you know, whether or not there was a thing to use at home, which is maybe a little bit of corruption, or maybe it's just normal. I mean, people have laptops that they take
Corruption is
home
normal here.
and use and stuff like that. But, you know, like Symbolics once a long time ago had a marketing campaign for list machines that basically said, you know, if you had one of these, you could have a smaller organization, because they would be so powerful that you wouldn't need as many people or something. And that's actually not only not appealing to the people who might get laid off, it's not appealing to managers who want to feel like they have powerful things at their fingertips. So the fact that you're telling a story in which a manager does some bit of busy work so that they maintain power at their fingertips doesn't sound like that much of a change in a lot of ways. You know, I was talking to a friend the other day and talking to them about the issue of the power consumption, for example, the different kind of power issue, power consumption of these things. And he was saying that while he agreed, he didn't think that was the high order bit in what the danger of LLMs is right now. And he was saying that the real problem is that we're dismantling perfectly valid organizations that are functioning well, doing their job well. And this is sort of like what you're saying. It's a kind of by analogy, except that you were talking about how people do individual commands. But he was saying like there's this promise that if you completely reorganize your company, you know, around this other technology, that maybe you can do the same or better. And you know, maybe better, but maybe you'll just end up failing completely and have nothing. And that it's very experimental to be doing that at this particular time. And there's, you know, groups that have a lot at stake that are sort of pushing for doing this, but it is sufficiently unproven tech, and the paths to it are sufficiently unproven that there will be a lot of externalities of businesses that didn't understand how to do this that fail, even if some businesses can show that they're going to be successful. And this is a very bad time in history to have things failing, when possibly crops are failing, possibly climate change problems, possibly democracies will be falling, possibly just a lot of things going badly, having companies just gratuitously fail because they want to me too on the LLM bandwagon seems.
Yeah, and that was what the manager who was kind of complaining to me about, the head manager of their division. He didn't have any like specialist support, or hadn't had a personal communication or anything. He was just parroting, like, I guess, some business CEO marketing talks that he'd heard, was what they'd got from that that meeting. I have a New Zealand climate technology adoption example, just because you kind of mentioned this being a bad time for this. And so something, New Zealand used to be world famous in the world for our radio technology, or our kind of military adjacent radio technology. And so New Zealand has or had contracts all around the world for radio infrastructure. And in the last 10 years, or I guess 5 years, maybe 5 years, the New Zealand government, I guess, you know, since Peter Thiel is kind of our New Zealand Epstein class person in chief. No, I shouldn't add that, sorry. New Zealand got into Starlink, Elon Musk's Starlink, and the government had this very expensive contract with Starlink, which is satellite-powered internet. And then they completely cut maintaining New Zealand's own radio infrastructure out of the budget. And then what happened was, last year, no, maybe 2 years ago, sorry, there were extreme weather events that had like taken out a road due to a landslide or something like that. And they had to have a meeting about, like, with people at the location about what to do about this landslide that has taken out a road. And it turns out that Starlink is affected by extreme weather events.
I was expecting this, yeah.
Yeah, but what they said to me afterwards was, it actually turned out that the government higher-ups having these meetings really are not very important to the problems being solved locally. I don't know if you can take that for what you will. But yeah, so that was an example of New Zealand, which used to be world famous for military-grade radio infrastructure. They got a government contract with Starlink, which was expensive, and they partially argued paying for that by defunding maintenance of disaster scenario equipment. And then, yeah, the extreme weather events ironically meant their Starlink wasn't working for the meeting. Yeah, well, that was my kind of other bit there. Jay Lamutt is saying, the other problem with satellite is that the bandwidth in the radio spectrum is finite. It's not like you can just run another fiber line. You need long fiber optics to reach the satellite. And then MD Hughes is worrying, sooner or later the satellites are going to come down, and we have that odd belt of debris that's making kind of satellites difficult somewhere. All right, well, this was my kind of wandering environment and kind of leaking things people send to me from inside the New Zealand government. Was there anything you were hoping to get to, or ideas you've had to get to, Kent?
I didn't have anything specific, although I will say one thing on the satellite. It's not just that.
Yeah.
It's that when you make an investment in something, people, I mean, you're making a commitment to a particular kind of thing. So you can't buy into Starlink without also buying into the notion that humanity has to be constantly pumping things into orbit. It's not just that they'll come down, but it means that no matter what happens in humanity going forward, unless you want to lose your ability to have that communication, you have to keep making satellites. So if there's a rough patch where, for example, we can't launch satellites because the weather is too strong, then suddenly the whole world is cut off if that's really what you're doing. I mean, we need to make infrastructure that is robust against the foreseeable problems, and the foreseeable problems include things like big storms and flooding and avalanches and things like that. So probably fiber optic underground would be a good thing. I mean,
Though a
it's
landslide would probably actually take that out as well.
well, if it was underground, maybe not. I mean,
Oh,
that's the thing I'm
sufficiently
saying is,
underground, I guess.
right, like you don't want to have wires above ground, because there are a lot of things that could just a storm could take that out and stuff. So we do need to repair that. But in principle, I mean, like some of them might decay, but you would have at least some of them working in the case of a disaster, and you would not just be cut off from everybody in a
Yeah,
way
and
that,
so that
you
basically, I guess Elon Musk started a new company, and some people in kind of power at that point in the New Zealand government just kind of went all in on Elon Musk's new satellite company. And now, and
know.
like lots of what you've just described, what everybody is describing in the Moo, these aren't mysteries. Anybody could kind of think and I guess even write a government report or something with these opinions and observations. But they just kind of gambled on it, and then the problem that people thought would happen did happen. Didn't really change anything. We're a Starlink country now, I guess.
Well, it's a structural and both financial and structural too big to fail play, because there's some reason to believe that LLMs are succeeding on their own merits, but there's also a lot of reason to believe that they're succeeding on, right now at least, on budgets that are justified because it's research. And one thing to understand about research budgets is that they tend to be cyclic. You get really a lot of investment, and the way DARPA used to work with, and maybe still does for all I know, is to pump a lot of money into something that they want to see happen. And then after a period of time, what they want is something they refer to as COTS, COTS, commercial off the shelf. And they're hopefully enough funding that at the end of that time, somebody's got a business that can make it inexpensive to get that. They cut the funding and they just start using the inexpensive thing. But if you're making something that relies on being big and you're not sure if there will be funding there, then making sure that it's part of critical infrastructure is a good way to make the government rescue it if it's going to fail financially later on. So that's the kind of thing I'm thinking, is that some of this is just try to be in the critical path of things strategically, and that's kind of an unfortunate way to maintain your favor.
Yeah, the DARPA strategy that you just described, which was great to hear it put like that, and by you as well. What they're suggesting is, for example, with Lisp, I guess, after ANSI Common Lisp, they didn't really need to keep spending money developing Lisp. Is that a reasonable description of DARPA's lack of funding after ANSI Common Lisp?
Well, I don't know that they funded that.
Or, yeah, I
The
guess.
funding was indirect for things like that, because they were certainly buying a lot of, things that were being made in Lisp. Maybe they were funding some Lisp efforts. They were trying to reduce the number of fundings of projects in a lot of different languages was the thing. So I think what they had done was funded AI projects, and that each AI project was in a different language, and that they were trying to nudge people to consolidate on one language so that they just had to do that. So I don't know exactly where they were placed in the financial ecosystem there, even though I do think that they were in there. And
But
yeah,
I
so
think one
yeah.
view of it could be, like a romantic notion I would like to believe in, is that to some extent with ANSI Common Lisp, Common Lisp had grown up. And I guess even now, decades where later, ANSI Common Lisp, or like Lisp, is in the popular programming indexes, like top 25, maybe at place 24 now, being hotter than COBOL, but which we've spoken about before. I like this notion that Lisp sort of grew up. But so, if we were going to use satellites strategically like this, we would like that technology and kind of technology ecosystem
You just
and
cut out on me, so I
sustainable
don't know if I can make it for you.
technology ecosystem to have grown up. But that's not really what happened. You know, a business guy basically made a elevator pitch, and then that's just what New Zealand's critical disaster infrastructure is now, except it didn't work.
Yeah. I wish there was no politics that worked that way, but it sounds like a familiar concept from politics, so yes.
We did get a message on the Mastodon from Nix Freak, who's a townie, whatever that could mean. I was tagging townies the other day when I was getting really, really, really excited about Lamdimu. Would you mind talking about Lamdimu a little bit? I'd also maybe we could segue, connect it to Lisp via Harlequin, something like that. But would you mind talking about Lamdimu for a few minutes?
We
Oh,
can.
and
That's a sort of
I've
undirected topic, but I can certainly talk about it. Do we have somebody else on that's talking about it? Is that what you're saying?
No, we just had somebody asking where I'd been talking
Sure.
about running your own moos or wizarding your own kind of private moos on, like, say, your desktop computer that you would then connect to remotely. They were just asking what happened to this topic the other week. And so I was wondering if you could talk about, as part of laying the ground for kind of mooing as a mature technology, could you talk about your involvement with mooing? Maybe taking the direction of your involvement with Harlemoo and your involvement with Mosaico.
Yeah, I mean, I would. So I was part of the Lamdimu community. I'm sort of not specific about exactly where, but the it was a the Lambda Core was something that you could obtain, and I made my own Moo at home, for example.
Which I've
Mosaico
just
was
done
it.
for the first time.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun because it just comes up saying, "Hi, you're in the first room," and then that's pretty much it. You have to make every object and every
Dig, dig,
like
dig.
every. Everything, so yeah, I made one that for inhabiting with a friend, and just we kind of just built a house where we could sit around and chat. But I stopped in at in Portugal, there were some people there building a bilingual Moo. And I said, "Why don't we make it multilingual?" And they said, "Why don't we make you a wizard?" And so I ended up there for a while. Mosaico is it was an attempt at incorporating as many languages as possible, which was an interesting challenge before Unicode. So I mean, voluntarily at not my pressure, but sort of theirs, like when they wanted to use accent marks, they just followed the letter. Like A apostrophe was like an accented A, or A followed by a tilde was what a when the tilde should have been on top of the A, but there was no way to do it. And we built a whole environment around that, where when new people would arrive at that move from elsewhere, I would go to the store and buy a dictionary about their language and try to incorporate a few words from that in a way that we experimented with multilingual descriptions. And being able to, instead of on Lamdimu, you would say something, you would make an object, and you would say, "Describe object as, this is my favorite pen," or something like that. But at Mosaico, you would say, "Describe object in English as that," and then you could also say, "Describe object in Portuguese as this other thing," and it would accumulate a list of the different descriptions with little markers in the list that said what language they were. And then there were a lot of tools.
Human powered as well in this.
Try to help you. Yeah.
Yeah. If I could just, I'll describe that a little bit myself. And then I have some notes on what Jelamat, Gothpenny, and Edaj are chatting about in the Moo and Fullspan and everybody. So one interesting thing is, as Edaj describes mooing, she says it's a chat room with programmable scenery. And so the interesting thing that struck me about Mosaico is that most, like, physical objects or just kind of objects or programmatic objects in Mosaico are quite well translated. Like, you can set your native language to Portuguese or Spanish or English or French, and then the objects check your default language, and you can see what's happening around you very clearly in your native language, which in my case is English, I guess. But then speech, people are still typing in their native language, so there isn't an integrated system for translating natural text. It's that all the well-known objects are simply idiomatically described in the way appropriate to that language in each language. So you can watch what's happening, the English story of what's happening with objects in Mosaico. But then you might not be able to speak directly to the people who are exercising the objects. Or, like, you could speak if you have like a feature object for a greeting. There is a feature object for greeting, for waving, for example. The waving feature object in Mosaico is a good example of a multilingual object, right?
Mm-hmm. A social verb, yeah.
Yeah. So I guess you could kind of programmatically communicate to some extent like that. Then I just wanted to mention, Jelamat was saying, so Jelamat has been working on programming his own Moo, and I have, of a time, worked on writing a Moo in Lisp myself, though I came to the conclusion that kind of supporting and participating with Lambda Moo itself as a Moo implementation, which Roger Crewe, I guess, currently maintains and develops. I came to the conclusion that compatibility with that was important. If you look at, like, 5 years ago, somebody did literally rewrite Lambda Moo in Rust, but they were completely compatible with Lambda Moo. And so because compatibility with Lambda Moo, the program that Lambda Moo is running on, is so important, I would like to stay with Lambda Moo. Then they were saying, for example, they want Unicode. So as somebody who's recently built Crewe's Lambda Moo, which had, I guess, 1.9.0 release in October of last year, it does support Unicode. The thing that doesn't support Unicode is the classic Lambda Core database, which has 2,000 initial verbs, like at dig, at program, and like the room prototype class, the player prototype class. The problem was that database uses things that were affected by changing from 32-bit to 64-bit integer architecture. So, like, if you had an array of integers, that array of integers is now a different size. And also, that Lambda Core database isn't compatible with Unicode in some way, or the character operations aren't incompatible with Unicode. Like, if you imagine a Unicode rune could be multiple characters long, for example, and the Lambda Core database.
They made Mosaico take Unicode later on, and
So Lambda Moo itself does support that. Yeah, so it would be possible.
The issue that comes up is that, you know, when you go to do like if there's code that is trying to do like string comparisons and stuff, there become two different ways to say it. In fact, we tried one of the cool things about Moo is that you can make a verb which corresponds loosely to a function, or method in other languages. A verb can have a name which is a string that has spaces in it and basically becomes a list of possible names that you could use. So you could have if you're going to have a food or something, you could say have a string quotes and you could say eat and then a space and then like come or something, C-O-M-E, for the Spanish verb or something, and the different things, and you could have a lot of different ways to say that, and interactively that works fine. If you call it as a function, then what you get is a Tower of Babel where you can no longer grep for anything because you want to search for a particular name and you find that there are several possible names now, and so you have to search for all of them or use regular expressions. It's just a big mess. And so we finally concluded that we needed to program only in one language, even if we were going to support multiple languages. And that was just a sort of a local decision we made. But you do create this problem that anytime you have different notations, that you have to figure out what you're going to do about comparison, and different comparison operators either do or don't want to see those kinds of differences, and you can't change that without it being visible to programs and so on. So there's big retrofitting, things like that is very, very hard. So they only did that somewhat. So in Mosaico, you see some things that use the new style characters and some that use the old style characters. And Mu is really like I think it's an incredible piece of technology, and it was a fabulous sketch of the future. Exactly because it was so simplistic that you didn't worry about such details and you just worried about broad brush patterns of what kinds of things would I like to make in the world, and not so much about everything being photoreal and precise at the detail level. If you wanted to go back and do that detail work, I would start over with something that was just similar and not try to be compatible, I guess I'm saying. But it was wonderful for the time that it was in, because it really allowed us to explore where things were going. And I learned so many things about what the future would be like from playing around in Mu.
Though there's no way to get that 36 years of experience in a new project. I guess you could say you've tried to internalize everything that has been learned from four decades of Mu programming and then make a language that kind of reflects that wisdom, but is more sophisticated with hopefully growing computer scientific sophistication. But I do think both things are true. For example, I think Common Lisp, there's a lot of stuff about Common Lisp that is just better than Mac Lisp. And just better than Lisp 1.5, but I also have the sense, especially with Common Lisp, that there's no way to get another specific language definition that had that much history when it was standardized, and the standard has survived for this many decades since that point. If I write a new language, like let's say I write, I don't know, what's a Lisp like language people have invented, if you write Elixir or you write any of the other Lisp similar languages, or you write Clojure or something, I think you actually lose, you no longer have the literal connection to that original standard. But I was feeling that way. And if you wanted to try and program the LambdaCore database is 2,000 verbs yourself, that's an astronomical challenge. Given that we have Roger Crewe maintaining the LambdaMu server, which version 1.9 has full, I think, Unicode support. There's some caveat there about not using Unicode in some situation. I was kind of enthusiastic about it. But could I ask, so obviously, Mosaico and your personal server both used LambdaCore, which has evolved over time, but is still pretty similar to that. I guess HarleyMu also started from LambdaCore. Were you involved with HarleyMu? Are you able to talk about
it? Yeah, I wrote a lot of HarleyMu. And yeah, that was a pretty straightforward thing of just building rooms and stuff like that. We didn't build a whole lot of technology in there, whereas certainly in Mosaico, we not only added the internationalization, but we separated a lot of the structure to be different. We separated the wizard class from Liquid. I don't even remember what it was called, but we separated it into sages and mages so that you could have wizards that could only see things but not do things, and then a more powerful kind of wizard that could see and do things, for example. And we did a lot of reorganization of the tools because we had to be in all the tools anyway, in order to add the internationalization stuff, which was just incredibly complicated experiments. I mean, I was really, yeah, good.
Is Mosaico's core database available?
I don't know. It might be. I
If
mean,
there's a
I
Unicode.
haven't used it in quite a long time, and there are people that still do. Like, I drop in now and then, but there are people that do things more actively. I mean, I started using their system in 1996 or something like that, and I finally, by the way, met the other two wizards at a conference, a Lisp conference, when I was there in, like, I don't know, 2018 or something. I'd known them for like 20 years and never met them, but both of them showed up for my talk. Anyway, it was
Yeah,
interesting.
thank you so much for that series of as we talked about, you were completely unprepared for the topic. Sorry, Jeremy underscore list was just sharing that Moose verb subject preposition object has a better resemblance to New Zealand's Māori kind of family of native languages here, which is an interesting bite, though I'm not as familiar with Māori as I probably should be.
Yeah, one of the things
Sorry.
also that's changed since the original Moo is that, see, Moo relies on a trusted server. It's not just a language, it's a system. And the time sharing part of it and the permissions management part of it relies on everybody trusting the wizards. And in the modern world, that's a very complex thing. It's still important, but it's tricky to figure out. You would have to figure out the trust model,
And there's a nature of giving people programmer bits. You can't give a programmer bit to somebody who actively wants to hurt your moo, for
No, that's
example.
not true, actually.
No?
No, because that's the whole thing about the trusted model is, as long as the wizards are trustable, you can give programmer bits to people who are not wizards, because
To
it's like
crazy
having a
people.
regular account on a Unix or something, or Linux, is like they're appropriately sandboxed to where they can, really can't hurt it anybody. Sometimes you need to whiz their things to add root terms to a particular verb, and that has to be done carefully. But that's the whole thing about the security model. It's different than the way other programming works, so that even if you subclass somebody else's class, there's a very careful attribution of, like, which of the inherited variables do you have
Yeah,
control
like
of,
the
and which one.
read, execute
And
permissions. Yeah,
so
that's actually
all of
a
that kind of
very.
stuff, yeah.
And so, just aside for people who are used to Unix, that idea becomes extremely sophisticated in Moose kind of small talk like inheritance with those permissions. Yeah, that separation of
The whole
things.
way that Moo manages security is worth anybody who cares about security studying, I think, because it's so different and so clever in a lot of ways, very, very thoughtful. And even if you weren't going to do the same thing, it's one of those things like if you're going to program in Java, you should still study Lisp just because it'll stretch your mind in a certain way. And I feel the same about, like, studying security and looking at Moo. So, yeah.
So that's a heartbreaking reality. I think everybody in Lambda Mu has experience with Lisp. They were hired for their Java job because they were a Lisp programmer. I think most people here have that specific anecdote. I think Edaj and MD Hughes and several others. But then they don't let you program in Lisp in Java somehow, unless you're at a closure company now, I guess, which is only loosely a Lisp. something like that. Okay, we're down to 10 minutes. Do you mind if I start rhapsodizing about my own personal deep learning thing to you? Because I just wanted to mention that, because I've been trying to turn that into a paper for the European Lisp Symposium, if I've got that call for papers deadline right.
Sure.
Oh, okay. Well, but Kent doesn't necessarily endorse anything I say. So what I did, this is the common Lisp side, 10 minutes of the show, I guess. I wrote one family of deep learning inferencing functions, I guess, in Lisp. Okay, that was a great start. What I noticed was one of the numbers that comes up in this formulation, fairly general deep learning family formulation, is just a function applied to true positives plus true negatives minus false positives minus false negatives. And I split that into four variables because those have real meanings. Like both are true, both are matches, both match, both mismatch. This one matches. This one is true and mismatches. This one mismatches. The other one is true. Something like that. And I was quite satisfied with how this works, because once everybody always says deep learning is statistical, and I hadn't, to my knowledge, only I have written this receiver operating characteristic formulation of deep learning inferences, which has interesting ramifications for training deep learning as well, because then hallucinations that happen when you perform a deep learning inference, which is a statistical operation, as people tell us, has a very clear and completely interpretable meaning in terms of like what the receiver operating characteristic values were that led to this hallucination happening. Anyway, so that's what I'm kind of working on at the moment, as my kind of Lisp thing. What Lisp stuff are you working on recently, Kent?
I haven't been working specifically on Lisp. The main place that I run into Lisp issues, I have a very long-running conversation with ChatGPT on a variety of topics, and I keep making Lisp references to it, and just as ways of summarizing various kinds of things. And I use it as a metaphor for various kinds of things, but I don't use it in my normal programming. Not that I do a huge amount of programming right now. I've been off doing other things in my life for a while, and I'm just sort of starting to ramp back up on the programming side of things. So, so I haven't decided whether or not I'll be exactly what language I'll be working in or whatever. With there's such a pressure to do everything with LLMs and stuff. So,
well, as I was talking about at the start of the show, did you know, for example, when you have given talks or you talk in interviews or you've spoken at length at various junctures on this show about the common Lisp condition system, have you spoken to how like frothily enthusiastic other characters in the Lisp community are about the Lisp condition? Like, I didn't realize when I was talking to Robert Strand how much he just loves the ANSI common Lisp condition system. And you know, it's peerless, and no other languages has, even though they've tried to take features from Lisp, nobody has succeeded to do this. Then people will argue over its kind of elegant beauty of how handler bind can be implemented in with dynamic variables containing handlers, something like this. People really, really wax poetic. I've been spending time in SharpSign Common Lisp on LibreChat IRC, if it's not obvious. But so, do you have like a roll call of people who are just crazy for the common Lisp condition system?
I mean, I get mail from people from time to time saying they like this or that thing about, you know, Common Lisp or conditions or whatever, but but no, I don't really like have things tacked to my wall or anything like
you're,
that.
You're not triangulating who the users of the Common Lisp condition system.
Not really. I mean, like I sort of consider it like born into the world and stuff. Like during the time I was making it, I was. I felt like I was the caretaker of those ideas, and I was worried about them not getting lost. But sort of once I foisted it on everybody, I figured they would all be experts because they would be finding all of its irritations, and they would be learning things in a much more visceral way, and they would either like it or not, but that it would not be mine alone to possess, but rather just part of the fabric of things. Because in a way, I didn't really make up a lot of the ideas. There are a few tweaks that I put in to make it do this or that. Like I think I'm responsible for it being more active than passive in the way handling works, because in the new error system, it was you returned a proceed type and you hoped that the caller would use that to figure out what restart. And I thought, like, I can't leave that to chance. So that part I'll claim. But like a lot of it is, you know, just me stewarding it into the new... into a new venue that survived longer than Zeta Lisp did, really.
What you were just describing with the new test system was, this is Zeta Lisp, right?
The new error system, NES, thing Dan Weinreb and Bernie Greenberg, and I'm not sure who else was involved in producing that, but it's probably, you know, it's documented somewhere because I tried to keep track of the history of it and stuff. But yeah, those ideas came into Zeta Lisp that way from PL1 on Multics earlier. And a lot of stuff was added in that process, but they got their original ideas from there. And so I just felt like it would survive longer if it was in a better vehicle, and I wanted to see it in Common Lisp. And so I made the portable implementation of it. I did the sort of rah-rah, you know, you should try this and that sort of thing. But, you know, and I did the work of working with a committee to get some consensus on the details of how we would cast it, because it is different than the way it is in Zeta Lisp, but it's still, I think, many recognizable pieces.
Yeah, so I didn't realize, I think Robert Strand had mentioned to me offhand before that, you know, he was very happy to be the person who named the McClim extension software, which is a set of tools, which has a set of tools useful for condition handling and inspecting. He named it Inspector Clouseau. But then when I was watching Common Lisp, and like he's basically there waiting to encourage and kind of foster people moving in the condition system direction. So I was kind of happy to see that on the IRC there, and it's nice to underscore when you give the history of these things, like you were just describing, it's kind of it coming out of Zeta Lisp there. At the start of this episode, you were talking about that there were kind of both the above ground and underground kind of Lisp information publishing tracks, and I think the ANSI Common Lisp condition system is quite a strong underground track, or it has a slightly underground feeling, and it's quite amazing to see it kind of burst up above ground now and again, was I guess what I was saying. I just wanted to say to Jeremy_List, who was trying to give a statistical description of deep learning, look at my statistical description of deep learning. Receiver operating characteristics are metrics that are based on true positives, true negatives, false positives, and false negatives, and you can turn those into some metrics. Look at my one. It's more clear than your explanation just there, I think. Northern Lights is asking, how is the LT going? Do you remember what this is, Kent?
How is the what going?
LT going? I might have... Yeah, I wasn't sure what that meant either. I was worried that something critical had slipped my mind. We're totally out of time. Thank you, everyone, for being here. Thank you, Kent Pittman, for all the great historical notes. Northern Lights says leprechaun trap. They're discussing some moo thing. Thank you, everyone, again. Thank you, E. Dudge, who went to bed after her successful cookies, and everyone else. And if I add at here, did we get anyone particularly new? Nope, it's all the same people currently chatting in Moo. Thank you everyone on the Mastodon Day. GGXX says happy St. Patrick's Day. Oh, I guess. Is it St. Patrick's Day?
NPR News.